Are we nearly there yet? Thank you for laughing. What parent has not heard those words? Are we nearly there yet? I can remember one time when we were driving to Vancouver and Alistair was about 3 and we got as far as Swift Current and stopped. And he said, "Are we nearly there yet?" And what I'm looking at this morning is very much, are we nearly there yet? Kaylee had a clock that represented the church's year, which goes round and round. But there's another image as well. The years don't go round and round forever. We're on a journey. That's now a well-worn cliche, but it's true of the progress of the years, which have a beginning and an end, not tied together. For here, we have no lasting city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. It's been a hard year, and this sermon series on Hebrews has been timely. Being a Christian is a way of life. It's not just another thing that we do amongst the other things that we do. We're growing into maturity, into a deeper relationship with God, and we do that together, encouraging one another, and as I will say later on, by what we do as much as by what we say. The destination of all of this is the transformation until we become remade in the likeness of Jesus Christ. And he is the center of our hope. There's a German word, and I don't know German, so excuse me if I pronounce it wrong. But it's in the Oxford English Dictionary because we have no translation for it. And that's the word Sehnsucht, which means a yearning, a craving, pining, longing, desire. And Hebrews is permeated with Sehnsucht, longing for something that is not here yet. And until that comes, we can find no satisfaction. And the message of Hebrews and James, which we studied before Hebrews, and also 1 Peter, all written about the same time, was that feeling that there's something missing, that there's something we are longing for that has not happened yet. Are we nearly there yet? If you remember your Old Testament history, the Jews were taken into exile in 586 BC, and they lived in Babylon, away from the land that God had promised them. 70 years later, they returned, and when they came back, they rebuilt the walls, they rebuilt the temple, but it wasn't the same as what it had been before. And in one sense, they felt they'd never come back from exile. They felt they were still in exile. They'd come home, yes, but it wasn't the same. Partly because the Babylonians owned the land. It wasn't really theirs anymore. Then fast forward to New Testament times, and Herod rebuilt the temple again, which had fallen into disrepair. Politicians love to build buildings. And we read in Luke that the disciples point out to Jesus how glorious the temple finally looks. And you know what he says to them? It'll be destroyed, which of course we know it was in 70 AD. There would be false teaching. There would be times of persecution. And this would be an opportunity for them to testify. And he said that by your endurance, you will gain your souls. And Richard spoke a couple of weeks ago about endurance, perseverance. This is a time of perseverance. But Palestine at that time was ruled by the Romans, and the land was not theirs anymore. For here, says the writer to the Hebrews, we have no lasting city, but we're looking for the city that is to come. This search for the new city controls everything we do now if we are Christians. I recently, 2 weeks ago, got a new car. It looks just like the old one, except it's full of bells and whistles, and I keep discovering things I didn't know. It comes with an app, by the way, and you get a notice on your app if there are things in your car that needs attention, that need attention. All right. I was driving the other day in an area of the city I hadn't been for a while, but it's where we used to live many years ago. And as we drove past, I just had to turn and look to see if our old house looked the same as it always did. And I got a beep from the car and a notice on the dash that said, "Keep your eyes on the road." I didn't know when I was buying the car that I would get all of this with it, but very timely. Yes, I kept my eyes on the road after that. As Christians, we need to keep our eyes on the road and look for the city that is to come. We're in an in-between time. Jesus has come. There was the resurrection. We are saved by faith in him. And yet we're not there yet. We're in that in-between time. What is going on? God is reaching out, as Jesus said in Luke's gospel, to everyone who does not know him before the days of the final judgment. And we, as Christians, are intimately involved in his reaching them. So what do we do in the meanwhile? How do we keep our eyes on the road? If you read on a couple of verses past where Enosh stopped, into verse 16, I realize that is a summary of the whole book of Hebrews, where it says, "Do not neglect to do good and share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God." Do good and share what you have. Do you remember the story of Naaman in the Old Testament? The Aramean commander of the army who suffered from a skin disease and who had a servant girl who came from, or slave who came from Israel. And she said to Naaman, "There's someone in Israel who'd be able to help you. Why don't you go to Israel?" And he did. You know what happened when he got there? Elisha didn't even come out of his house to see him. He sent a messenger to him and said, go and wash 7 times in the River Jordan. And Naaman was angry. He'd come all that way, and that was what he was told. But he did do what the... Oh, he said, by the way, are not the rivers of Abana and Pharpar in Damascus, wouldn't that be a better place to wash? No. Wash in the River Jordan. He was angry because what he'd been told to do was such a trivial thing. Why had he come all that way just to be told that? Well, we are told to do good and to share with others. And we might have expected something a bit more impressive than that. How ordinary that is. I feel like Naaman. At the beginning of the chapter, the writer to the Hebrews laid out in a bit more detail what it means to do good and share with others. And there are essentially 5 things that he says, and I'd like to speak for a minute about each one of those 5. The first, it gets translated in most of our Bibles as let brotherly and sisterly love continue. It's just 2 words in Greek. And the first one is Philadelphia, like the city. Brotherly love, loving one another. Let that continue. Our church, I think, is outstandingly good at doing this. I'm not going to mention names, but some of you will know who you are and some of you will know who others are here. The city was requiring, heard the other day, that we clear the snow in front of our houses. Well, neither Reed nor I are able to do that. And someone from this church phoned us and said, could I come by and clear your driveway? A snow angel in our church. Meals. We are incredibly good at providing food for one another. And I've been on the receiving end of that and so appreciative. It means so much. And I know someone in this church who gets a meal every week from somebody else who cooks it for him. There are people in this church who knit toques and mitts for children in schools. And we know how much those are appreciated by children who otherwise have no toques and mitts. And I even heard of someone who has lent their house to somebody who needs a house for a short time. And so on. And there are, I'm sure, countless other things I don't even know about. We're good at Philadelphia. That is Philadelphia. And let's do more and more of it and find more and more ways to show Philadelphia to one another. Interestingly, the writer to the Hebrews calls that a sacrifice. And probably people who don't do it think of it as a sacrifice. But there's a cost in energy and attention and time in doing these things for one another. And with such sacrifices, he says, God is well pleased. The second thing that is part of just loving, doing good and sharing what we have is hospitality. And I don't know what you think of when you see the word hospitality. We're not talking Martha Stewart here. The Greek word for that is philoxenia. Philadelphia was loving your brothers. Philoxenia is loving the stranger. Loving the person who's not part of your circle. When Reed and I were engaged, we took a trip right across the United States and ended up in California. And I'll never forget, we spent a day in San Francisco. And then we drove up the coast, the west coast of the United States, to a place which belonged to some friends of some others who were traveling with us too, to stay the night. And the arrangement had been that we would get there in time for lunch the next day. And we got delayed, and through no fault of our own, we didn't arrive until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. This was for lunch. And so I was mortified that we were so late. And these saintly people were not the slightest bit put out, and she said to us that she'd prepared something that could keep in the oven all day if it needed to, because she knew that it was possible that we could be late. And these people, they spent their time outfitting, preparing people to go who were missionaries before they went to sea, overseas, and provided them with everything they needed. And they were so hospitable. And when I was thinking about the word philoxenia, loving a stranger, they epitomized it. They were wonderful people. Just one day, many, many years ago, that stands out in my memory as an example of philoxenia, loving people whom you don't know. And along with that is the next one, which reads strangely to us, that we're to love those in prison. And this requires a bit of cultural explanation. Roman prisons were not like our prisons. Don't think about our prisons at all. They may have been just an ordinary building that was where someone was kept in chains, couldn't escape. But nothing was provided for the prisoners either. And so a prisoner was dependent on other people to bring them food and anything else that they needed. A second century writer, who was not a Christian, he refers to how people brought in meals and how Christians read the scriptures to people in prison. They didn't have a Bible, of course, but Christians came in and read the scriptures to them. And how Christians were eager to extend the prison, the communal experience of the house church. And it suggests that the early church regarded a ministry to Christian brothers in prison as a corollary of the responsibility to practice hospitality. Well, we don't have that kind of situation today, but we need to think of creative ways in which we can bring the Christian faith to people who aren't able to do it. And I think of our shut-ins. And I know people in this church, too, who visit those who are shut in and bring them what they need. Then the next thing that is singled out by the writer to the Hebrews is sexual ethics. And don't we know it, that this is an area in which the devil loves to attack. I read the blog by Scott McKnight. In fact, I read it every day. And he has a series he's doing based on a book about what is called deconstruction and reconstruction in the lives of mostly young Christians who cannot continue attending church the way their parents did. They cannot accept what their parents have done in honesty to themselves. And so they drop out of church while they think through for themselves what it means to believe. And one of the things that causes them to leave the church more than anything else is seeing marriages fail amongst Christian leaders, and worse. And we've read about some of the horrific sexual sins that have been committed by Christian leaders. Totally disillusioning. Christian love for one another goes hand in hand with a high regard for marriage. And I want to say that everything about this is countercultural now, as it was in the first century. The social norm is to act solely on the basis of self-gratification. If it feels good, do it. And a commitment to honoring marriage permits a closeness amongst us that others can never know, which in turn is a powerful witness to a God whose very nature is steadfast loyalty. And I want to tell you a story of when Reed and I were engaged, which was for 2 years while I finished up my degree at Oxford and Reed was at Ithaca, New York, at Cornell. And there was, of course, no social media. There was no iPhone. There was no way that we could get in touch with one another. And at my college in Oxford, there was one phone for the whole college. We were not socially connected. It was a very difficult 2 years. And I did come and visit him in the summer, and that's when we went on that trip to California. But during that time, it just came back to me just the other day thinking about this. One of my friends said to me, "Aren't you worried that while he's away, he's in the States and I'm in England, aren't you worried that he'll find somebody else? Don't you worry about that?" And I have to tell you, that never crossed my mind. We had made a commitment to each other. And that gave me the freedom to have all kinds of friendships with other students at Oxford, some of which are still good to this day with people, because they knew that we're safe with one another because we've made a commitment to somebody for life. Then the next one is don't be... The Greek word is philargyroi. That means loving silver or loving money. And as I was thinking about what illustrations I could share with you about Christians not loving money, a memory came back to me of someone, again, I had known years ago, who lived in Boulder, Colorado, whose name was Eugene Thomas. And I checked on the internet to see where or what Eugene Thomas was doing now. The reason I remember him is he was a businessman who was very successful as a businessman. And he also worked for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which is what had brought him here in Regina, where I got to know him a little bit. He visited on more than one occasion. Can't remember why, but he did. And the thing I remember about Eugene Thomas is this. He had a number of successful businesses in Boulder, Colorado. And he owned a laundry. And the laundry was an absolute disaster. It could never be anything other than a total disaster. And why? Because he hired people who couldn't get any other job, the unhirable people. And he used the profits he made from his successful business to run this laundry. So he never got rich because the money all went into the total disaster of a laundry. But he gave a meaningful time to people who worked for him. So that was years ago that I met him. And looking him up on the internet yesterday, actually, discovered he had died 9 years ago. And I read this comment in his obituary, and I want to share it with you because it says everything that this chapter of Hebrews is saying. This is what one of his friends wrote when he died. It's safe to say that without Gene's teaching on Jesus as a teacher and not merely a sacrifice on the cross, thousands like me would have lived a much less rich and vital life, waiting for heaven, but not knowing how to participate in God's rich kingdom day by day. I would not trade that foundational teaching in my student years for any sum of money. Gene's life, his stories, interwoven with Jesus' stories and assertions, was the genius that drove this teaching home. The life lived in joyful opposition to the world that controverted all the quote-unquote wisdom we college kids had imbibed from our parents, professors, and the surrounding culture. That life that Gene and Jerry lived, the great adventure of following Jesus and doing the crazy things that Jesus advocated, was what validated Jesus' words to me enough for me to take my first risks in his name with money, relationships, humility, and worship. Eugene Thomas and his laundry. And then finally and briefly, imitate your leaders. And I think this is one of those commands that we shy away from, especially if we're in any sense leaders ourselves, with a false humility. Oh, no, don't worship me. No, please don't. Don't imitate me. And I want to say there's a responsibility of church leaders to live exemplary lives. We can't get away from it. And we're about to elect a new diaconate, and I pray that members of the new diaconate will not only exercise gifts of wisdom and practical gifts, but also may live lives that the rest of us can imitate. We're told to imitate our leaders. So those are the things that the writer to the Hebrews singles out as things that we should be doing while we wait for Jesus to return. A counter-cultural lifestyle that gets other people's attention. It speaks to those who have not yet trusted in him. They notice these things. May we be characterized as people who live like that. And meanwhile, we wait with expectancy for the city that is to come. Amen.